Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Infinite Tennis. I'm your host, Bill Patton. What is Infinite Tennis? Infinite Tennis is becoming infinite coaching and does success coaching to athletes, parents of athletes, creative folks, people who are making decisions, facing a crisis, or need to get to a higher level. It's recognizing the drive within a person to be great and helping to mold that. Infinite Tennis is knowing when to cooperate with others for the greater good. Our guest today, Steve Johnson Sr., does those things. He is a great guy, and we're going to have him on the show here in just a moment. First, we're going to go to our first commercial here. When we come back, we're going to bring him on the show. So where are my commercials? Anyway, hey, you know, we're going to shift gears here really quick because all of a sudden, I don't see a commercial to play on my board here. So, Steve, you're always ready, aren't you?
I'm ready to go, Bill.
You're always ready. So, you know, I'll fiddle around here with my little control panel thing here. And if I find it, then I'll clue you in as if we're going to have a commercial. But looks like we might be first. So, Steve, how's your day going so far?
Well, it's early. It's sunny, though. Looks like I might get a teach today. It's been raining the last couple of days, so I'm looking forward to get back on the court.
Excellent. So tell us a little bit about where you grew up and how did you learn how to play tennis?
Well, not the very typical story at all. I fell into tennis by accident. I was playing baseball, basketball, a little football. And then at 16 years old, my sophomore year in high school, I was going to focus on basketball. Played my first year in high school and did real well. And so I was going to drop baseball, but I needed to take a sport so I didn't have to be in regular PE. And so the athletic director and I talked and at Orange High School, and we just decided, hey, go out for the tennis team. That way you can be in sixth period PE and, you know, do that. Well, I absolutely fell in love with tennis, played that year, played then my senior year, and then played a couple years in college at the junior college. So I fell into it by accident. It's all I've done ever since. Still love it, and it's crazy.
Yeah, that's terrific. So, it was essentially just your senior year that you played it?
Or my senior year. So
okay.
I just got thrown into the fire real quick, played 2 years of high school. Taught myself, never had a lesson. My idol was Bjorn Borg. My family's ancestry is Swedish, and so for some reason I like him. Plus my good buddy who was on the team, who was the one who kind of pushed me in, he was a big Connors fan. And so I just had to go with Borg, so we had something to argue about every day. So I had a two and a backhand. I was the only one. This is back in 75 and 76. I was the only two-handed backhand on my college team. My coach still makes comments about that, how I was the only two-hander he's ever coached.
Yeah, that's interesting. I also idolized Borg, but I guess I went with the Guillermo Vilas backhand. So I never had a two-hander myself, but I did love the heavy topspin.
Yep, absolutely. You bet.
Coaching yourself, what was that like? I mean, how did you improve that way?
Well, you know, didn't have all the social media stuff we have access to today. So I watched tennis whenever I could on TV. I got Tennis Magazine. I would go down to the courts and watch people play. I'd ask people, you know, who are the good players. I'd just watch them and then try to emulate them. I watched, like I said, Borg was my main person I watch, and then I would hit on the wall at Orange High on the racquetball course for hours. Didn't have access to a ball machine. I was never a member of a club or anything, so I'd ride my bike down, or actually got a car then my senior year, and I just hit on the wall and hit with anybody who hit with me and my good friends on the high school team.
You know, that's interesting because, you know, our generation, I think we were the last real generation to hit against the wall on a regular basis. How did that go the way of the dinosaur? I don't know. But
absolutely. I tell my kids all the time we have a wall at the club, and they ask me, we have a wall? So I'm with you on that.
So, you know, and who was I talking to? We were talking about the when you're hitting on the wall, you get into that land of imagination of 3, 2, 1, he makes the shot. You know, you do the whole rehearsal of, you know, you're hitting against the wall and you just passed Jimmy Connors for the Wimbledon title.
Absolutely. I did that many times. it was usually Jimmy Connors who I was passing.
Excellent. Okay, so then in community, you went to play at a community college, and did you get some solid coaching there?
Yes. That's where I got my first real introduction to tennis lessons and structure and technique and stuff. His name is Lee Ramirez. It was at Santa Ana Junior College. I actually, when I met you a couple weeks ago up north at the convention, I think I told you, I had just come back from spending a week with him. He is now 81 years old. He lives in Hilo, Hawaii. And
wow.
he's been a part of my life, helping mentor me since I was 18 years old. He's a very influential man in my life, probably second after my dad. So 37 years he's been helping me. And he also, you know, knows Stevie. He comes over to the mainland, and he actually gave Stevie a volley lesson back when Stevie was about 8, 9, 10, and so very, very close with him, and enjoyed my week with him.
You know, when I was listening to you talk, it affirmed something in me because I'm actually branching out into life coaching, and I think that's something that more people should take up that mantle. So I thought that was fantastic that not only, you know, do you have people who kind of coached you along, but you also have players who come back to you year after year, and you take care of them. You know, and
absolutely. We have that relationship, and that's very important to me. Obviously, I don't get it with everybody I teach, but, you know, there are some that I'm still very close to from when, you know, they're now adults. They're now 35 years old and have children, and I'm still in contact with them. So it's very cool. It's what I think I'm supposed to be doing, and it's what I love to have in my life.
Well, and I would think one of my objectives in this talk that we're having is to come up with the solutions for the so-called American tennis problem, and I think that's one of them. I think developing those relationships that are lifelong or have the potential to be that's one of the stronger solutions. But as tennis pros, you know, we're encouraged in our early training to have professional detachment. And I've just never bought into that.
Correct. That's interesting. So, I was told that at my first club. The director heard that I was hanging out with my students, going to their, you know, matches, and then going out to dinner with them. I was at their birthday parties or their graduation. And I was told, look, they're an hour. They're your hour. That's it. And I refused to do that. So I talked to other people, and they said, no, the reason we do this is because we like the kids, and we like to help them, we like the relationship. So I am very familiar with what you just said.
Okay, so do you have any stories from having played tennis or been out on the road with people that are, you know, that kind of show how incredibly fun the whole experience can be?
Well, I'll tell you, with Stevie playing at SC, I traveled, my wife and I, Michelle, we would travel with the team to the national indoors. We traveled to the NCAAs every year. Obviously, it was a dream with the USC team winning 4 national titles as a team. Incredible feeling to have it happen. And then Stevie won 2 individual titles his junior and senior year, and you know, the people who I got to meet, the people who I get to come across, be a part of a daily life is just, it's beyond what I would have ever dreamed as a kid, because my son's actually living the dream that I had. He's played at Wimbledon. I've seen my son play at Wimbledon. I've seen him play at the U.S. Open.
Yeah.
An amazing journey that tennis has taken me on, and now it's taken it to a whole nother level with Stevie. It's so cool. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, and I guess you never get tired of saying that USC won four titles. It sounds like you're still pretty fresh on
it. when we were going through the process of picking schools, it was more stressful than we all thought, but we came to a realization that he wasn't going to pick a bad school. The schools interested in him were all wonderful. They had really good men running their programs, very important to us. SC was a good fit because I knew Peter Smith personally from the business, being around the area. It was close to home, so Michelle and I could go see him and the family. We felt they would always be in the mix to have a chance. Obviously, I didn't know that they would win four, didn't have any idea, but amazing place. We spent most of our Fridays and Saturdays there watching and enjoyed our time there very much.
You know, from your talk, I think what's probably going to happen here is I'm going to go off script a lot, because there were a lot of things about your talk here in NorCal when you came to Marin County. And you were talking about that decision of Stevie to come back for his senior year and how fraught with pressure that was. Can you get into that a little bit?
Sure. I think it was very misunderstood by most people. They thought he should turn pro. You know, we got a lot of opinions. Stevie, number one, had so much fun playing in college, he wasn't ready to give up one of his years. Number two, they had won three in a row. Only one other team, Stanford, had won four in a row. He and Daniel Wynn, the other freshman who came in with him, really wanted to write some history, and they were able to do it. But probably the toughest year of his life, of my life, Peter Smith might answer the same, knowing that if the team didn't win the fourth and if Stevie didn't win NCAAs, then it would have been looked at as a failure and a poor decision. So probably as stressful year as you could get for a group. All the guys on the team were stressed. They didn't want to be the ones who didn't win the match, that didn't make this dream come true. So pretty much a tough year, but we also felt it would build him, helping him ready himself for the tour with the stresses he would deal with there.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm naive, but I think that I would try to, as a coach, kind of manage that and put my finger on that immediately and say, hey, guys, yeah, I mean, it seems like it's all about the four championships, and it seems like we have to all do it for this one guy, but in reality, is that really true? I mean, do we really have to do that? Nobody comes back from the dead if we do it, and nobody's going to die
right.
If we don't.
Peter downplays everything. Peter keeps the guys loose and light. His speeches right before are quiet. He doesn't yell and scream. He's just a calm guy talking to him. But it was there. You know, everybody knew it. It was in the back of everybody's mind. It wasn't spoken about. Okay. It wasn't a day-to-day thing.
Okay. It was just bubbling under the surface constantly.
Yes, right, exactly. It was absolutely under the surface. Peter did everything he can that he was able to. He and George Husak, who was the assistant, did a great job. But, you know, everybody knew what was at stake. But, again, it turned out to be a dream. So it was a good one.
And, you know, that's an interesting concept, because I think that people – I remember hearing the idea that pressure comes from within, and people choose pressure for themselves or they don't, you know, and
right.
So you can actually choose not to feel pressure.
Absolutely.
And so I think but managing that in such what is externally a high pressure situation, I mean, I guess Peter handled it masterfully and the players managed it very well themselves. So I think that's even more a testament to how well that was done.
Absolutely. It was good. I mean, on that note, I think that's one of the biggest problems I deal with junior tennis players and their parents is that they play their kids up thinking if they play better people, they get better, when in fact all they're doing is ducking the pressure of playing their peers. And I think that's one of the big problems with United States tennis is the kids play up too much.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's my opinion on that.
Okay, so let's shift gears and talk about your coaching. And I mean, besides Lee Ramirez, were there some other influential coaches that influenced the way you coach?
The way I coach? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Probably the one, I mean, because I got into tennis coaching, again, same thing. I got into kind of by accident. Once I got out of college, I wasn't good enough to play at the next level, but I was hired by parents to hit with their kids, you know, play points with them, hit with them. And then that turned into I started teaching. I worked for a couple of the city recreation departments, and then I got a call from a club here, and they asked me to come and teach. And so his name was Greg Jablonski, and he gave me a job at the local club, and that's when I started. I then quickly moved on into working with a bunch of good juniors. I seemed to be okay at what I was doing, and I got into the USTA, into back then it was called the CTC, the ATC, that was working with, you know, the teenage kids, 11, 12, 13-year-olds. So I got to meet Greg Patton. I got to meet Wayne Bryan, and I just listened to them, you know, went to all their, you know, their events and listened to them and saw their passion, and I was always a fan of Mike and Bob Bryan, so I got a lot of inspiration from Wayne and Greg.
That's great. You know, Greg's my grandpa, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure he loves hearing that.
Yeah, I'm sure he does. Okay, so he has said so many horrible things in public about me that I have to take my opportunity. And I doubt he's even listening. He doesn't care about this stuff. So, now, what were some of the things, though, what were some of the principles that you picked up along the way working with all these great people?
Number one was the relationships. Both of those guys are big on the person, developing the human being. I think that was the main thing I got. I think it made me feel so much more competent to have confirmation that these top pros said, you're a part of their life. You're a mentor to them. You're somebody who they idolize. You know, I realized a long time ago I can tell the kids to do their homework, and they do it. And their moms call me and thank me, saying they don't have to be the bad guy anymore because, hey, Steve said do your homework. I realized that a long time ago. So the ability to have relationships to help them achieve their goals, to see something ahead of them. You know, they're kids. You know, I predominantly work with, you know, young kids through college, and it's just fun to see them attain their goals, whether it be high school or college. It's just a fun ride for me to be along with them.
You know, I love that, and I know that that we're similar in that way, and I know I've lost business because of it, and I've heard secondhand, oh, that parent didn't want that for their kid. They don't want you to help them with their character. And so, my reaction is, okay, good riddance, because now I'm left with all the people who are really on board. Have you seen that same type of thing, too?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. I also find that honesty loses me a lot of business, too. You know, several of the pros in my area are willing to tell the parents that their kid's going to get a scholarship to USC or UCLA, when in fact they are not even in the ballpark. But something I've learned long ago was the parents don't know that they don't know. And that's something I battle with every day. So I'm trying to be honest with them, point them in the right direction. Somebody else tells them full ride, whatever. And, you know, I've been through it. My son didn't get a full ride for a couple years. And he was one of the top players in the country. So I do deal with that probably more than the other. I've had a few people leave, but mainly it's because I'm honest with them and I try to put them on the path where I think they can get. I'm not trying to squelch their dream. I'm just showing them reality, where they're ranked, you know, what kind of level those kids are going to be playing at.
Right. No, that's great. And you know, I was just reading Lisa Stone's Parenting Aces, and she had blogged about the difference between golf and tennis, and how
that was a great article, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I mean,
and so,
I love that. You know, she and Colette put that up there. That was great.
Well, now I think we need to run with that kind of thing. How can we get it so that misinformed or misdirected parents can really kind of start to see the light of you know that they really ought to participate in the greater community of tennis instead of just isolating themselves and you know doing 100% of the coaching or you know being subject to all these false promises from the ne'er-do-wells out there. How can we bridge that and start including that in tennis?
That is probably the greatest question I've ever heard anybody ask, and I've been asked that before. And, you know, I look at golf all the time. I golf on my free time, and some of my friends' kids, they're actually putting them into golf because they come and tell me how well-structured it is from the very beginning and how it's run. So it seems to me that golf has something from the very top all the way down that gets them in, whereas tennis, I think everybody's kind of out for themselves. I think that's our biggest difference. I don't have an answer. I actually wondered the other day out loud if maybe that's something I should put my mind to and put some time into it of helping and coordinate that. But it really is a problem for us, and I think it hurts us in the big picture that we don't have a more structured situation.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of the difference between cops and firemen. You know, firemen are all part of a family, and you know that guy's gotta you know, have your back, or you could end up burnt to a crisp, right?
Yeah.
Cops
yeah.
All suspect each other of wrongdoing, and they're always on the lookout for a dirty cop. And you know,
yeah.
A cop knows you're lying because your lips are moving. You know, so it would be nice if we could get more into that fireman family mentality, and you know, it takes a village to raise a child, kind of a thing.
Absolutely, I agree.
Let me indulge you with a quick story, because I was running tournaments. I was running sanctioned tournaments, and lots of parents loved my tournaments because we played fair. We had court monitors, and if kids were acting up, we jumped on it. And if there were bad calls, we knew about it before the kid asked for a lines judge. And if we saw a bad call, we kept the court monitor there watching, because we know the power of when people are watching. My tournaments became kind of a lightning rod for controversy, and eventually I kind of got squeezed out. But there were some parents very, very sad because they felt like at my tournament, fair play won.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I hadn't heard about it till now, but we've done the same at mine, and I was told not to do that. I was told I'm not the new sheriff in town. What am I doing? So this is great. You sound real familiar to me, Bill. This is great.
but now, I think what we need to do, though, is we need to take this and say, hey, you tennis pro who's listening right now, you know, do this kind of stuff. Influence your sphere of influence. You know, I mean, let's move away from that. I think we definitely are in agreement on all that, and that's part of the reason why I wanted to have you on. So, I mean, I sometimes like to have people on that I don't agree with, but sometimes it's nice to. All right, so now, besides your son, who are some of the players that you're proud of for whatever reason? And maybe it's not because they were the greatest player, but because they overcame something through tennis.
I've had several good ones, but the two, I have two that just stand out. Number one, they're both girls that I had. Jody Baker was my first student that I was in charge of 100%. I was her coach. You know, I hit with her, went to tournaments with her, actually went on vacations with their family, with my family. She ended up playing, you know, at a small school in Whitworth, and her senior year, she won two rounds in the final tournament to make All-American status. And that's probably one of my favorite stories. Another one I have is a young lady named Gina Pellizzini, who now works for the SCTA in their department. She ended up, she would live with me in the summers. She lived out in Rialto, and I live in Orange. So she would come in the summers and live with me to be, you know, hitting with me every day because it's a 60-mile one-way trip. And then during the school year, her uncle would drive her down and go down to the beach and fish and then come back and pick her up. She ended up going to Nebraska and had a great four-year career. So those two stand out to me the most because Jody was the first one and Gina was the next one. Most recently, I've had a young lady named Christina Tan who was from that area. She's right there by my club, and she ended up getting a full ride to Syracuse, played for Luke Jensen. So got to speak with Luke Jensen quite a bit, and that Trojan connection again came up. So those are probably the ones I think of the most of my favorites. They were all great kids and still in touch with all of them.
You know, I love Luke Jensen. I think he was one of the most talented tennis observers. I really love listening to him commentating on a match.
Yeah.
You ever listen to him? Somebody hit a big forehand and he go, "That's his boy."
Yep, he's funny.
He's really excited. There were a lot of Luke Jensenisms that I incorporated in my coaching with my high school kids.
Yeah.
And
you will definitely get some loose ones, you bet.
The kids thought I was nuts, but that's okay. They were right. All right, now, so what do you wish that you'd known at the start of your tennis coaching that you now know?
That's a great question. I think what I know now most that I didn't was the delicate balance between the relationship between being the coach and dealing with the parent and the child. Obviously, we can't do what we do without the parents. We need them. They obviously pay the bill. They drive the kids. They're the ones who take them to tournaments, bring them to lessons and clinics. So, but it's a very tricky balance since they write the check, but I'm supposedly the boss. And that's a tricky relationship. So learning that through the years, it's still an ongoing day-to-day process because I'm constantly trying to train people to understand what their role is. I've actually come up with paperwork that has the child's do's and don'ts, the parents' do's and don'ts, and the coaches. And I usually sit down with them. We sign it, tell them, look, this is how it works. If any of us break these rules, you know, it's like a broken wheel. So it's such a tricky balance to make that work. But when it does, great things happen. Magic can happen.
Yeah, that's I like that. And, you know, recently I heard someone say that in your first coaching session, this was talking about life coaching, in the first life coaching session, be sure to do something that could get you fired. Get fired in the first session. And then we're going to go, the live portion is going to end here in a moment, but the recording into the podcast will continue, so we can ignore any of these warnings that come up. But no, you know, get fired immediately, and then you know where you stand, right? I mean, I had a kid not too long ago, and I know that the mom has her idea of how the lesson's supposed to go, but the kid wants something different. I asked the kid, you know, what do you want to work on today, and he did something different than what the mom said, and then we start working on what he wants. And then I even said out loud with her listening, I said, well, what if your mom fires me? And then now she can't fire me because I said that.
good stuff.
Well, not immediately anyway. Just maybe in a couple of...
I've never worded it the way you did, but I realize I actually kind of do that because I just tell people right up front, this is how I do it. If it's a problem, I've never thought of it the way you put it, but that's great. That's exactly how I feel.
Well, and I can kind of do that because I'm not at a club where people are watching me all the time, and I don't have to leave. And so there's a lot of freedom that I have creatively like that. So it's not something I recommend to people, Except that be powerful and don't kowtow, right? So,
right. Back to what I said earlier, they don't know that they don't know. And then the scariest parent is the one that, because they've been hanging around talking to other parents on the weekends, they think they know. And they're very difficult. So that's exactly it. They're the most difficult parent to deal with.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's a good idea. What do you think of this? I mean, if you have somebody and they come to you and they have, you know, the kid is really ambitious, I like to have a 1 hour sit down with the parent and really outline what's this relationship going to look like, and then really look into their eyes and see if they're buying in. Because I don't want to monkey around with something where they're going to be micromanaging it. But then it's funny, I had one recently where I was talking to the parents and laying out the whole thing and advising them not necessarily to listen to other parents, but if they do, to bring it back to me. I would love to hear what you're hearing, and then we can talk about, is that a good thing or not?
Yeah, you know, that's a great idea.
You know, I think it's definitely a good idea to make sure that everybody always feels like they have a voice.
Absolutely. So, they should. You're right. I mean, it is their child. They are a part of this, so they absolutely should have one. But, like you said, help you. Let me keep you straight on that. So that's great.
Okay, so any other tips on handling that delicate relationship between the three?
What I do is I just try to make sure it's out in the open as soon as possible. The first time we meet, this is how it works. You know, you can talk to the other parents of the kids I coach, find out how I work so that you know what you're getting into, and, you know, we can have this great ride, and I hope it continues for as long as we can. So I know very few of them last forever, but, you know, hopefully they last for a good time.
Yeah. No, absolutely, and that's terrific. I think everybody should really consider being that open, honest coach, because I think it feels better to be that than it is to be holding back on information that you know you could say, but you're afraid that your income's going to diminish because you were honest. But have you seen this where maybe sometimes you have a kid and they're not your favorite client and then they leave and then all of a sudden the next week three more people show up?
I have had that a few times. I was kind of crushed that somebody left just because I liked the kid, but I couldn't get along with the parent. But then, like I said, next week another kid or two come in and I just kind of laugh at it. But, yeah, it has happened a few times.
Yeah. Okay, so now, what can we do I remember in your talk again, you know, talking about how, you know, sometimes you get have these parent meetings and it's like preaching to the choir, you know, only the parents that really need to hear it. The parents
I've tried to have meetings with parents, and I offer, you know, it's free, I offer them to come down. Show them how tournaments work, how the point system works, how you get from one level to the next, and pretty much the ones that come are the ones that already know it because they've already listened to me and they bought into it. So it gets a little frustrating sometimes, but I do try.
Is there a way to bridge that so that you get a higher percentage? Have you found ways to get the ones that you really kind of force them to come, for lack of a better word?
Well, what I've tried to do is I've tried to build an event around it that they would not want to miss. You know, have somebody there to hit, or, you know, have a free clinic, or have a parent-kid, you know, clinic where they can hit with their kids and be on the court. But, again, it's just the ones that stick around and ask the questions are the ones who are already on board. So I have not found a way to get the ones who I really want the message across to show up in numbers. That's not happened yet. I'm still working on that.
Yeah, I don't know. I have this thought that if all your good parents can be, if you can kind of delegate to them, make them deputies and try to have them try to reach one, each one reach one kind of a thing.
Great idea.
I mean, I would assume I would assume that your better parents are also fairly well respected by the parents that maybe don't have the buy-in. So
absolutely, because usually my better parents, their kids are doing better. It's like, to me, it should be so obvious. Look, these parents listen. They follow the path. Look what their kid's doing. They're moving on every year. Look, they're in a better place. They're moving on. They're reaching their goals. It's always amazing to me that then these new ones come in and want to fight it and think they know a better way. So, tricky one.
Right. So now, you know, junior tournaments are they're such an interesting zoo. And when did it happen that the rules weren't really being followed? And, you know, what's our way of managing that?
For me, you know, I had my run-ins with the SCTA down here, and to me, the problem always came back. My theory was is that there wasn't enough discipline from the SCTA to the kids who were habitual problems. You know, every Saturday and Sunday, somebody got a line judge. They would no call, no show. I just had one of those a couple weeks ago. One of my kids won his first round, you know, had a three-hour wait, came back, and then the kid no-showed and didn't call. But, you know, there's really no penalty for that child. So then my kid, who does everything right, plays by the rules, you know, they're very unhappy and upset that they stuck around for 3 hours and, you know, little things like that. But it seems like they're very afraid to be the enforcement. So I think what it does is it hurts the people who are doing it right and makes it tougher for them. But I can only mention Southern Cal. This is the section I know. So think we don't – I don't think we have enough authority or enough penalizing, you know, structure in place to make these kids – and it's not the kid. It's obviously the parents who choose not to bring their kid. But, okay, I understand that, but at least call. And it's a tricky one. It's tough to sell the sport as it is. And then when people come back and say, hey, I waited around 6 hours to play a match, I got a default. And the next day I played number one seed and I got to beat 0-0. I mean, that was awful. You know, that's a tough sell to get these parents to stick with tennis. So it's a constant battle.
If you're playing soccer, you know when your soccer game is and you know when it's going to end.
You know when it starts and ends.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. All that. You know, I think one thing I do with my parents is I let them know that, you know, anything that they see that's not right, they really ought to consider, you know, writing a letter and speaking up about whatever, because ultimately the tournaments are the players' tournament. And, I think the one thing that I see in our society overall, and not just in tennis, but leadership is missing out on the silent majority. Because there are a lot of people that don't want to say anything, positive or negative, they'll vote with their feet and with their dollars, and they'll just show up, and you won't hear a peep out of them. But there's the silent majority that's going to be very happy when it's run correctly.
Right. Agreed.
Okay, so.
Absolutely.
All right, so now we were talking, you know, I asked you about the college programs and helping players, you know, bridge into a pro career so that they don't have to go to, you know, horrible places with horrible cracked courts and all that and fight their way through the thousands to the 800s to the whatever. How can college teams, you know, and I asked you how many college programs legitimately are a springboard to the pros, and I was really surprised by the answer. So can you kind of answer that again for our listeners here?
Sure. I think a handful have produced. After saying that, I would like to say, though, it's more the kid and, because there's schools that just have, you know, one kid here and there. But lately, you know, Virginia has put out a lot of pros, SC, UCLA, Georgia, you know, the top schools, you know, they're always in the hunt at the end. They're usually making the quarters and the semis every year of NCAAs. But for us, we just felt college was such a good part of the path to the next level, because very few kids at 18 are physically mature enough or emotionally mature enough. Like you just mentioned, how many kids at 18 want to travel the world to be in a future somewhere that they don't even know where it is, to try to get 6 points to be number 978? So
right.
I actually spent some time, you know, after you and I decided I would be on your show, I talked to some of the smartest people I know, you know, the college coaches and the players, and they came up with some great ideas too, is that, you know, look how many kids try to turn pro. The problem is we don't hear about them. You hear about Sam Querrey. Sam was ready. He is one of the few. Sam went right out of high school and turned pro, but he's fine. But, you know, there's 100 kids who try to do that who never got into the top 200, and now they're just gone. And I think those are sad stories. And, you know, going to college doesn't mean you will make it. But let's be real. If you go to SC, UCLA, Stanford, Georgia, Virginia, and you're not near the top of the lineup, everybody you play pretty much week in and week out is going to be a challenger-level player. These are the best kids. You know, they're not weak. And you have the coaching staff. You have the doctors. You have all the help from these other people instead of being by yourself. I can only use Stevie, you know, as my example, is that in that 4 years, he got physically stronger, emotionally stronger, mentally stronger. Coaching on the court helped him get through some tough spots, and, you know, he dealt with a lot of pressure. So to us, there was no question that college was going to be a pathway to it. It hasn't been that way since the late 90s. It has now turned. As you'll notice now, most of the guys in the top have gone to college for some amount of time, maybe not all 4 years, but they use
right.
it to get bigger, stronger. So, you know, you look at Bradley Klon, Ryan Williams, Tennis Sandgren, these are all Stevie's peers. They're doing well. Tennis
yeah.
Sandgren just won a challenger last week. Stevie's won a challenger. Bradley won a couple. Bradley just broke into the top 100. So I think we're going to see that change now, because I think it's all changing to use college. I mean, there's going to be some kids. Jack Sock's doing fine. He went out. Dennis Kudla's doing well. They were ready.
Yeah.
But I don't think college would have hurt them, but they chose to go that path, and that's fine. But I think most of these kids do need that, just, you know, again, to get the help. Speaking with Dustin Taylor, he now is the the USTA coach working with college kids on their team. He traveled with them this summer to the Futures and Challengers to help them while they're still in college, to show them what it would be like. And I think that's a fantastic step, and he's the perfect guy to do it. He's just a good guy to help these kids make that transition from college to pro. So I'm hoping to see more go that route. I think that's a great pathway for him.
Yeah, no, that's terrific. And, you know, do you think it's worthwhile to, you know, challenge college coaches and say, hey, why don't you take on the goal of developing one top 200 player, so that then we have 20 college programs that are developing a top 200 player. And then from there, then it's up to the work ethic of the player moving forward.
Sure.
But do you think that college coaches would take that on as kind of, you know, part of their mission for American tennis?
I would say that they probably already are. I just might not know them personally, but, you know, the coaches at all these major colleges, they want to win. And so I would think that, you know, every guy they have, especially at the top one, two positions, that they're thinking that this kid's good enough to make that. So, I'm not so sure they aren't. I mean, it may not be in their mission statement, but I'm sure that's what they want, because it would also then help them in the recruiting process to say, look, these kids played here, and now they're on the tour, and they're number, you know, top 100 in the world, top 200. So I think it's a great, great help for everybody during their college career, as well as after, for the kids they can get in. So I'd like to think coaches are doing that already. I know the coaches that I know personally, you know, the SC, UCLA, Georgia, you know, Brian Boland at Virginia. I mean, they're very happy that their programs are that good and that they move people to the next level. It's very good for them.
Yeah. Now, tell me, do you write down your goals?
I do.
Okay.
I was told long ago by someone much smarter than me that if you write something down, it goes deeper into your subconscious.
Yeah. So here's what I want to say to any college coach who's listening right now.
I challenge you to write down as a goal, I will develop a top 200 player. And you know what? I mean, it really opens up the creativity, and you can find a way to make that happen.
Well, let's see a couple years if that happens, and I'll feel like I had a little bit of help in that.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's what this is all about. I'm not having a show, and I'm not having Steve Johnson on just for some chit-chat and so I can spill my coffee all over the front, which I just did and cleaned up. That's not why I'm doing this. Did you hear me cleaning that up?
I didn't. You're good. You're stealth, dude.
Stealth coffee cleanup. But, also, here's the funny thing. I was coaching a high school team, and the impossible thing to do was to beat this one team because they almost always won the section title, and I knew their team was better than my team, but I don't know what possessed me to do this, but I wrote on a 3x5 card, beat that team, and I don't want to name them here, but one thing happened after another, and we find ourselves in the finals against this team, and we needed a miracle to win the semi.
Yeah.
So here's the interesting thing. I wrote this goal that we were going to beat them, not even really thinking it was possible. And then an interesting thing happened. One of their players went and played a junior tournament because he was overconfident, because he thought that his team would handle us no problem without him.
Uh-huh.
And then what happens? We sweep the doubles and we win one of the singles, and they're up 3-1, but we win the last 4 sets that were on court to win the thing.
Nice.
And nice. I have to tell you, watching them accept their second place trophy was more satisfying than the win.
Yeah, no, that's great.
So to me, that's the power of writing down a goal. You know, I mean, I would hope that if I hadn't written it down that we wouldn't have lost, but
yeah.
I'm certain writing it down helped. So, okay, enough about me. I'm starting to talk too much about myself on these shows, so I have to cut that out. But all right, now, so is there something in college, in the college experience or in the junior to college experience that can be added or increased to help with the possibility of more top 200 players?
My answer to that is it would have to. I'm hoping that the NCAA will look at their rules. They don't allow a recruitable athlete, meaning a 14-year-old, to be a part of the college, team. And I think that's hard because, like, every year I take the kids from my academy to SC to watch the SC-UCLA match. It's a big deal, and they always have the in-and-out truck there, and it's a really fun day, especially if the Trojans win, which they don't always when they play UCLA. But, it's illegal for the coaches to have a relationship, and I think that hurts in the big picture. I think the kids should be able to come to these matches and be around them and have these college guys. I mean, to these, these 10, 11, 12-year-olds, Stevie and Daniel and Wynn and all these other college players were like, that was their idols. That was, hey, I know him. I've seen him. Peter Smith had a great program going after the matches. He would invite a couple of the academies in the area to bring their kids. And after the match, the kids were allowed on the court to hit with the players. And the players were wonderful. They'd stick around and hit with the kids, and they'd play games and a lot of fun and laughing. And, they'd each grab a kid and be a partner with them. And I just thought that developed a relationship with college tennis, maybe directly with USC. But there's just so many rules that keep the coaches from having a relationship with these kids that it's tougher. I wish that would change to help get them into college, which I think would then help them get better to be that next top 200 pro. I think it starts at that level, personally.
Yeah, and it sounds like a world team tennis experience, and I love world team tennis, and I've taken a lot of kids to go see that, even though it's a 2.5-hour drive from where I live. But we will go with juniors to Sacramento because I want them to, sometimes we can even get there early and maybe hit with one of the team members who's warming up for the day. I mean, that's how nice Wayne is,
Well, Wayne would do that, absolutely. He's the best at it, so.
Right. Okay, so now I know you also were talking about, you know, best athletes and all that, and I hear way too much whining about we don't get the athletes, and I'm thinking, well, either recruit them or make them. So it seems like coaches try to protect the kids by encouraging them not to play other sports. So, you know, what do you have to say about that and the whole athlete?
Well, in our situation with Stevie, he played every sport until he got to high school. He was on the basketball, baseball, football team, surfed, golfed. You know, he was with just me every week, and he kind of hung around with me and my buddies. Even though he was 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, he would golf with us and go surfing with us. And so personally for me, I've always been a developing athlete first. So in our little kids' classes, we have basketballs and footballs and hula hoops. And, you know, we do all kinds of stuff besides just hitting tennis balls when they're younger. So I'm a big believer in it. Plus, I just don't think too many kids can hit tennis balls only. And that's it, because I think that keeps them from achieving the athletic level they could. I think the other sports help that. So I'm big on that. Once Stevie got to high school, then he decided, look, I want to be a top player. I want to go to college. I want to try to get to the pro level someday. And so then he focused on tennis, played high school tennis, which a lot of kids don't, but he did play high school tennis, enjoyed it immensely. He likes being on a team. So for him, it was always an easy route, because the team thing is really fun for him. So I'm big on creating an athlete. I'm probably one of those guys who whines a little bit that we don't get the best athletes. But, again, if you look at tennis, it's hard to break in. The money's not there. If you're a good athlete, there's a lot more money in football, a lot more money in baseball. So I understand how some people look at that and would just say, look, tennis isn't the right thing. So,
well, let me interject and tell you a little story here, because here's a way it could go. All right. I have this kid, and he's a freshman, and I know he's, because of his strokes and his training, he's going to be my number one player at some point. So I was kidding around with him, and I lifted up his shirt sleeve, and I was surprised to see absolutely no bicep muscle at all. So I said to him, "Where is your muscle?" You know, and you know, we were kidding around. It was all in good fun. And, you know, the funny thing was, I just left it at that. I didn't think anything was going to happen. But that kid got really serious about getting in the gym, and he actually started taking boxing lessons, you know, which was kind of counterculture for him. I mean, it was very, very counterculture from what he grew up in. So he's taking boxing lessons and all that. And then when he's graduating as a senior – he was a legitimate contender for athlete of the year at the high school because all the other athletes saw him as an athlete. So
right.
So why are, you know, all we have to do is set that as sort of an expectation that, yes, you will develop your whole athletic being, because that's the way it works better. You need to cross train.
Right. Well, if you look at tennis, when I grew up in the 70s, you know, the guys were mostly 5'10", 140 pounds and little. But now, I will now say tennis players are the best athletes of all the pro sports. I'm a little biased, obviously, but if you look at what Djokovic and Nadal and Federer and all these pros do, it's pretty amazing. You know, they have to be returning 140-mile-an-hour serves, 100-mile-an-hour ground strokes, changing direction, 30-ball rallies. I mean, I watched Djokovic and it all play points, and it's just crazy what they're doing now. So I think tennis is misunderstood by people. They think it's just hitting a little ball around. But if they go see it live, not on TV, they'll see the physicality of it. It's not what they think.
Yeah. No, I think some tennis players could run the read option. And all you have to do to be a tennis player is be a quarterback, a shortstop, a striker, and a point guard combined, because you have all that decision making in a fluid situation while rotating diagonally backwards to rotate. You know,
absolutely.
You know, I mean, it's just insane. So, you know, so. What would you do if you could change something in the sport of tennis to make it better?
Wow, that's a great question. I guess for me, it would just be something that makes it more accessible to get more kids out there. If we could just make it be a cooler sport. I think we miss out on that. It's just because it's not easy. It's hard to do. It takes time, and, you know, it costs money. So, you know, it's just every kid I know has played soccer, and I understand that. It's a little easier to do. It's less money. It's a team thing. But if we could just find a way to make it cooler, which is what I try to do, I think we get more kids in it to get them going on that path, and they'd see what a great sport it is.
You know, I had a close friend, and he passed away not too long ago. I don't know if you ever knew Mark Manning, but Mark was in East Oakland, and kids would come by riding their bike, and he would yell at them, and he would say, "Get off that bike and get in here and get a racket right now. You're going to try tennis right now."
That's great. That's great. Now that's – I love it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I like to tell people, hey, come talk to me when you get sick of all the screaming at soccer, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, everybody, did you know that soccer has the most catastrophic knee and head injuries?
Yes.
Is that what you want for kids? You know?
Yep. I'm seeing that more and more. I've actually had kids come to me at the age of about 14, 15, and their mothers have said right away, soccer's getting too rough. Three girls had knee surgery already. Two girls have a concussion. We're going to try tennis. And, you know, the girl's a good athlete, so it usually goes pretty well. So I've had that recently in my life as well. I've heard the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, we have the greatest sport in the world, but we act like second-class citizens. So I think everybody needs to have a little mind shift there. And
I agree.
Wonder if people are good enough. Are you good enough to play tennis, Steve? I don't think you can handle it. So, you know, come to me when you think you're ready.
Yeah, maybe that's what we do, reverse psychology.
You know, I don't think you can handle it.
Yeah, it's too tough for you. Go back to soccer. Yeah.
Yeah, come back when you're ready. So,
yeah.
All right, now, how would you say that your coaching philosophy has changed over the years?
It's changed, I guess, in that I've become more, you know, the dream of playing professional tennis. You know, I tell the young kids, you know, when they're little, they should talk about winning the U.S. Open, winning Wimbledon. And now I realize that with 3-4% of all high school players actually play college tennis, I realize that's a dream, but it's an achievable dream. So I really gear the kids, and I really try to – and, again, I'm good friends with Greg Patton, so, you know, and Wayne Bryan. So college was good for all those kids. It's a good goal. It's a very hard goal, but it's an achievable goal. So I think my philosophy has changed that all these kids can play high school and succeed, and that hopefully they can play the next level, and the relationships that they'll have. I'm still in touch with most of my team from 1977 through 1980, my college friends. So I still golf with one of them every week. So that's, again, it goes back to relationships thing for me. I guess, wow, I say that a lot, so maybe that's my main thing.
Yeah, and, you know, I was going to ask, how would you put a wrap on this conversation and summarize everything, but I think your statement just now just did all that. So, because, yeah, it's about the relationships. It's about feeding the dream. It's about, you know, getting kind of that the all-sports athletic training to be a well-rounded athlete and you know, doing those two things, and you got it, right? So, hey, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was very enjoyable to talk with you, and I hope that people, you know, get some good stuff out of this conversation. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for the opportunity, Bill. I had a great time.
All right, terrific. Have a great day, Steve.
Thank you, Bill. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, everybody, so we're done for today, and I'm going to leave you with this.
Say what? Check it out, man. Rapping the best about infinite tennis. Radio show so dope, gives people a voice. Homeboy, don't test this. Hosted by
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.